Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Welcome everyone to this new episode of EAN Cast Weekly Neurology of this month, dedicated to neurological immune-related complication of cancer and its treatment. I'm Dr. Antonio Malvaso, and I'm attending the first year of neurology residence program, almost concluded to be honest, at Mondino Foundation, National Neurological Institute, under the Department of Brain and Behavioral Sciences, under the University of Pavia in Italy. Today it's a great pleasure for me to be the guest moderator of this podcast, and it's an honor to introduce an international expert of this field, Dr. Alberto Vogrig, who is assistant professor of neurology at the University of Udine in Italy, and he completed his PhD in neuroscience at the University of Lyon, France, with a thesis entitled Triggering Factors and Immunopathogenesis of Paraneoplastic Neurological Syndromes. And he also attended a period as former research fellow at Stanford University. His research focuses on paraneoplastic neurological syndromes and neurological complications of cancer immunotherapy. So I think today we have a big opportunity to listen a timely report on the most recent knowledge by a special guest concerning the paraneoplastic neurological syndromes, in particular on diagnosis and treatment. Therefore, thank you, Alberto, for this opportunity, and I think we can just start with the first question according to definition of paraneoplastic neurological syndromes. Specifically, could you explain to us the concept of paraneoplastic neurological syndromes?
So first of all, thank you, EAN, for having me, and thank you, Dr. Malvaso, for the very kind introduction. So paraneoplastic neurological syndromes are rare neurological disorders that can affect any part of the nervous system, either peripheral or central nervous system, often with a rather stereotyped clinical manifestation, such as limbic encephalitis, rapidly progressive cerebellar syndromes, or sensory neuropathy. These disorders occur in association with cancer, but this association is not only chronological in time, but rather causal. And also, they have an immune-mediated pathogenesis. In fact, we can find specific neuronal antibodies that we can detect in the serum, but also in the cerebrospinal fluid of the patients. So these antibodies are really good biomarker that can assist in the diagnosis of paraneoplastic neurological syndromes.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your timely definition. And you were truly very exhaustive and punctual. However, there are some points that I would like to clarify together with the auditorium also. For example, why did you say that the association with cancer is not merely temporal but causal?
So this is, I think, a crucial point that was really highlighted in the updated diagnostic criteria for paraneoplastic neurological syndromes. Indeed, recent studies have shown that the tumors of patients with paraneoplastic neurological syndromes are histologically identical to those of patients without such conditions. However, cancer of paraneoplastic neurological syndrome patients are different at the molecular level. For example, in breast or ovary cancers related to rapidly progressive cerebellar syndromes and anti-YO antibodies, the tumors harbor specific alteration of genes encoding onconeuronal proteins, which lead to neoantigens and subsequent immune tolerance breakdown that starts PNS.
Yeah, really very interesting. I think it's a crucial point. In line with your words, the histological molecular gap in this context is very significant. Actually, I think that providing more knowledge on this aspect could lead to better stratified clinical phenotypes. And for example, in the future, better management approach towards an individualized precision medicine. However, staying on the topic of clinical phenotype, I think that at this point we can enter into the heart of clinical practice. So, based also on your big experience, one of the most challenging aspects of paraneoplastic neurological syndrome of central nervous system is that they can manifest as different and frequently overlapping clinical syndromes that are often difficult to promptly diagnose or to easily categorize. So therefore, in order to better clarify to the auditorium what is the clinical panorama that we can find ourselves in front of every day in our clinical practice, I would ask you, could you define and briefly describe what are the main clinical phenotypes of paraneoplastic neurological syndrome and their immunological associations?
Sure. So we can start by saying that the recently updated diagnostic criteria for paraneoplastic neurological syndromes identified three main groups of neurological condition based on their association with cancer in high, intermediate, and low risk phenotypes. The first group includes specific clinical presentations defined as high-risk phenotypes and previously known in the previous diagnostic criteria of 2004 as classical PNS, which frequently have a paraneoplastic etiology. This group includes, for example, conditions such as encephalomyelitis, which we know commonly associate to small cell lung cancer, and anti-HU or CV2-CRMP5 antibodies, but also limbic encephalitis, which can be paraneoplastic in the setting of, for example, HU, CV2-CRMP5 antibodies, and again, small cell lung cancer, but also MATU antibodies and testicular cancer, for example. I think that it is really important to recognize two points. The first one is that the same disorder, let's say limbic encephalitis, can be clinically indistinguishable and being non-paraneoplastic. This is the case, for example, of anti-LJ1 encephalitis, which is a frequent cause of limbic encephalitis in the elderly, but also that disorders that are known to be not to be epidemiologically associated with cancer, such as multiple sclerosis, but also Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, should not be tested for the presence of neuronal antibodies and should not be considered paraneoplastic. So it's really important to start at the clinical level.
Okay, thank you very much. So clear, so helpful. And I was just wondering, as you previously mentioned, the traditional classification of paraneoplastic neurological syndrome and related antibodies has been recently revised by a panel of experts. For example, a collaborative effort from 19 experts from 8 countries to develop a new set of diagnostic criteria with the aim of improving the clinical management of these conditions and to encourage standardization of paraneoplastic neurological syndromes research initiatives. In light of your clinical experience and recent studies, recent literature data, the case of new randomized clinical trials, how can we make the correct diagnosis of paraneoplastic neurological syndrome?
So thank you for this question. I think it's a very important point. The first and most important aspect is to be sure that the patient fulfills the clinical criteria for a high risk or intermediate risk syndrome. One example of high risk syndrome, as I said, is limbic encephalitis. And one example of intermediate risk syndrome is brainstem encephalitis. So as always, in neurology and in medicine, it is crucial to make an accurate clinical diagnosis. Then neuroradiological studies and cerebrospinal fluid examination are very important for both supporting the diagnosis, but also to exclude mimics, such as infectious disorders, but also metabolic disturbances that can be frequent in patients with cancer. It should be also considered that each syndrome has specific oncologic and antibody association. So we should look for the associated tumor and search for the associated antibodies accordingly. In particular, the oncologic screening should be also guided by the antibodies found. But we can say in general that an approach with a whole body CT scan followed, if negative, by whole body PET scan can be recommended. Of course, in specific scenarios such as anti-MATU limbic encephalitis, We should also look for an associated testicular cancer with testicular ultrasound. In general, also, cancer screening should be repeated every 4 to 6 months for at least 2 years in cases of high-risk syndromes.
Very clear. And at this point, I was just wondering, what about the antibodies diagnosis?
This is a very important but also a difficult point, because we need to be sure that the antibody positivity are confirmed using two different techniques. And this is particularly relevant for antibody positivities that do not match with the clinical presentation. So again, I stress the importance of the clinical examination and the clinical diagnosis. Regarding the laboratory techniques that we can and we should adopt, I must mention that gold standard detection method includes rodent brain tissue immunohistochemistry, immunofluorescence, accompanied by confirmatory studies using immunoblot for most antibodies against intracellular antigens such as HU, MAT2, CV2, CRMP5, or cell-based assays for antibodies against cell surface or synaptic proteins such as NMDA receptor antibodies.
Yeah, very useful. But in this context, if I can, it is very important the centralization of CSF or serum patient samples to specialized centers in order to perform a second-level diagnostic detection methods, in particular when we have clinical features highly suspected for paraneoplastic neurological syndrome, but negative results to first-line diagnostic method. On the other hand, very remarkable the concept of low clinical suspect but positivity confirmed using two different techniques. I think these tips could be very useful for clinicians who will listen this to this podcast. So in the end, I couldn't ask the million-dollar question, sure that it will be certainly very helpful to young neurologists. At the moment, what is the best treatment for these conditions?
So I must say that paraneoplastic neurological syndrome associated with classical high-risk onconeuronal antibodies are often difficult to treat because they are resistant to immunosuppression. They tend to respond best to cancer therapy, if we can find the associated cancer, which is not always easy, especially in the early phase of the diagnosis. So if we do find an associated cancer, it is important to discuss early with the oncologist in order to treat the cancer as early as possible, because this is probably the best treatment that we can offer to the patients. Of course, we can also do a neuroimmunological treatment. In this scenario, we can adopt first-line medication, which includes the steroid bolus, intravenous immunoglobulins, but also plasma exchange. So these are first-line medication that we can adopt, in fact, in both paraneoplastic and non-paraneoplastic condition, for example, autoimmune encephalitis. So even before knowing the cancer status of the patient. Personally, I tend to prefer intravenous immunoglobulins or plasma exchange if I do not know the cancer status, because steroid bolus can reduce the dimension of a small cancer lesion. But there is no general consensus of that, and all these drugs are effective as first-line medication. If the patient do not respond to first-line drugs after 2 weeks, I start to consider second-line immunosuppression, such as cyclophosphamide or rituximab, with cyclophosphamide being generally preferred in condition with antibodies targeting intracellular antigens, such as, for example, HU. But before starting these second-line drugs, we need to discuss very carefully the case with the oncologist. So it is very important to do teamwork here, to be sure that there is no indication for chemotherapy for the associated cancer, because, of course, we cannot administer cyclophosphamide or rituximab concomitantly with chemotherapy. And also, we need to discuss carefully the cancer status of the patient before using this second-line immunosuppression.
Great. And what about symptomatic treatment? That we know that symptomatic treatment should be considered and may vary based on the underlying neurological symptoms associated with the paraneoplastic neurological syndrome.
So many patients with central nervous system involvement, such as limbic encephalitis or autoimmune encephalitis, also develop additional symptoms that we can treat symptomatically. For example, a substantial amount of patients develop seizures. And in this case, it is appropriate to use anti-seizure medication. It is important to consider that some of these cases, let's say patients that develop autoimmune encephalitis associated to LJ1, Caspar-2, GABA-B, or NMDA receptor encephalitis, tend to develop seizures in the early phase of the encephalitis. But then when the encephalitis is treated appropriately, the long-term epilepsy outcome is rather good. So we should use anti-seizure medication at the beginning, but then when the encephalitis is resolved, we can consider gradual tapering if we do EEG monitoring and we see that there are no ongoing epileptic activities on the EEGs. The case of paraneoplastic limbic encephalitis with seizures is a bit difficult, as we have recent data that show that these patients tend to develop ongoing epilepsy. This situation is similar also to other antibodies targeting intracellular antigens that are non-paraneoplastic, such as GAD antibodies. And in these specific scenarios, we should consider long-term anti-seizure treatment and also long-term immunosuppression.
Great. Thank you so much for your clarity, and I'm sure we will really treasure it. Once again, thank you for this very interesting podcast and for your work on this neurological field. I appreciate very much your capacity to make so simple the explanation of this heterogeneous and complex group of pathologies. So I would like to thank all the auditorium, and obviously thank you, Alberto, for accepting the invitation as a guest speaker and being here today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, Dr. Malvaso.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.